The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear two women talking about house cleaning. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 3. Listen carefully to the first part of the conversation and answer questions 1 to 3.
Well, Jill, I'm glad you had a nice holiday. We'll have to try it ourselves sometime.
Yes, Kate, you really should. I'll give you a contact number for the hotel we stayed in. Anyway, I must be...
Oh, I know what I meant to ask you. Sorry, it was about a cleaner.
Oh, yes.
Yes. We've been talking about getting somebody to come in and help out. You had a cleaner not long ago, didn't you?
I thought you said having a cleaner was a waste of money, that you'd never pay somebody to do what you can do perfectly well yourself.
Well, yes, maybe. But things have changed. Things are really hectic for Greg at work all of a sudden. He's never home till after 8. I end up doing everything. The house looks like such a mess. I never get time to tidy up before I go out to work. And in the evenings, I just about manage to cook and wash up.
Well, you shouldn't be the one doing everything if you're working as well. That's not fair, is it?
I think Greg's just shattered. Oh, to be fair, he's pretty domesticated. We've always pretty much shared the chores. It's just a temporary thing, I think. I hope. We're basically both trying to juggle too much. The last thing we want to do at the weekends is start cleaning. We want to relax a bit.
It's not because all the neighbours have got a cleaner, is it?
You know me too well. I guess there is a bit of that. I feel like the poor relation when I tell them I do all the cleaning myself. They can't believe I fit in so much.
Never worry about what other people think.
No. Anyway, one way or another, we need a cleaner. Well, as long as it's not too expensive, that is.
I don't think it's expensive, and it's money well spent. We only stopped having Tricia come in every week because I was off work with the baby, so I could do most of it myself.
So how much is it?
Well, Tricia was £8 an hour. I can't say that's what everyone charges.
That isn't bad, is it? It's less than I thought. Oh, well, I think we can run to £8. How many hours did she do?
4 hours a week.
Well, that sounds about right. Can you give me her number then?
Oh, sorry, no. She's not around anymore. She went back to Wales. I think it was Wales anyway, a couple of months ago.
Oh, no. That's a shame.
Wait a minute, though. We've had some leaflets through the door recently. Let me see if I can find one. I put one here by the phone, I'm sure.
You now have some time to look at questions 4 to 10. Now listen to the rest of the conversation and answer questions 4 to 10.
Ah, yes, here we are. It's a company. They're called Dusters.
Dusters?
Yes, as in people who dust. You have to phone Abby on...
Is that Abby with E-Y?
No, it's A-B-B-Y.
Okay.
And it's a local number, 650 918.
650918. Okay, got it.
They do ironing and can look after your garden too, apparently.
Ironing would be helpful. I loathe ironing. So, do they say how much it is?
Yes. It's £9.50 an hour. That's for all the different services.
£9.50? A bit more expensive, then.
They do a spring clean for £45.
So that's one big clean. Do they say how many hours that is?
No. It just says spring clean. I guess it's 5 hours. So it's a bit cheaper than 5 hours of cleaning would be normally.
Yes, probably. That might be a good idea to start off with.
You'll like this too, Kate. They can use organic products if you want them to.
Oh, yes, I'd prefer that. I don't like using strong chemicals. They're so bad for the environment. OK, I'll give them a call. Thanks for that.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a member of the Active Outdoor Club talking to a group of interested potential members. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 14. Listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 14.
I'd like to welcome you all to our Active Outdoor Club. I'll start by telling you a little bit about the history of the club and all that it can offer, and there will be a chance for you to ask questions over tea and coffee in the lobby afterwards. You'll also be able to pick up pamphlets from the table at the back of the hall, and if you wish to purchase any of our products, Bill will serve you at the front counter. As most of you probably know, the club was founded by Nick Noble about 30 years ago. He thought of placing an advertisement in the local newspaper or erecting a billboard somewhere. But it was the radio that he decided on to reach the most people. You know, other people who might be interested in outdoor pursuits. Just basic activities like walking or tramping. Anything active that could take place in some of the beautiful outdoor settings that this country has to offer. Nick was overwhelmed by the response he got, and the club soon grew from a dozen or so friends and enthusiasts to around 200 members 20 years ago. And steadily since then, to reach a membership of over 2,500 now. You don't have to be a hardened athlete or extreme adventurer. On the contrary, it's a group that encourages friendship and fellowship through social and recreational activities. The club tries to cater for all levels of maturity and both genders. In fact, anyone who has the physical ability and a moderate level of health and fitness to participate in open-air activity on a regular basis. I think our youngest member is a 5-year-old boy and our oldest member is a 75-year-old man. Of course, we have more challenging opportunities for those who are up to it, but all excursions are graded according to level of difficulty, and there will always be something for those families with small children. More about that later. I'm sure you realise that it's part of the focus of the club to ensure that our natural environment is kept as pristine as possible. We all have a keen interest in conservation and many of our members contribute their time or give a monetary donation to organisations that work to enhance and beautify our natural heritage.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 15 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 15 to 20.
Okay, now going back to the grades of activity, first of all, tramping. This is very popular with singles and couples without children, but is certainly not restricted to those groups. Tramping is arranged for Tuesdays and Saturdays throughout the year. Most tramps are of a duration of 3 to 5 hours, depending on the weather and the terrain, and of course the time of year. You would need to check the newsletter or the website to find out place and time, and if you wish to participate, phone the coordinator who can give you more information. I'll move on now to walking, which is very popular with families, but open to everyone, and walks are arranged for every Thursday and every Sunday over the course of the entire year. Walks last no more than 3 hours, although the Thursday walks might be shorter. And again, you would have to check the newsletter for details of the time and area to meet and get in touch with the walking organiser to confirm your participation. Now, the wanderers are what you might call a subgroup of the Active Outdoor Club. This group was set up to cater for the less active, more elderly, or families with very young children who still want to enjoy the great outdoors, but without quite so much exertion. Bear in mind that the length of these activities is variable, but we're always home before dark. Any member of the club is welcome to join in their activities on a Sunday, which include visiting some of our more beautiful parks and botanical gardens, beach walks, picnics, and even boat trips to visit some of the small islands off the coast. Often guided tours can be arranged if there is enough interest. If you'd like to see what the wanderers are up to, check the website and then phone the leader for more information. I'll bet you're all ready for that cup of tea now. But before I finish, I really must mention something that can be a lot of fun. A great opportunity to form new or strengthen existing friendships, and a chance to explore a part of the country that you may never have seen before. These are our mystery weekends. The committee puts a lot of time and effort into the organisation of these weekends away, not only for health and safety reasons, but also to ensure that everything runs smoothly and everyone has a good time. There will be a charge to cover travel and accommodation costs, but apart from that, it's an affordable and exciting weekend away from the city. For more information, call the chairman of the committee. You'll find his phone number in the newsletter. So, that's all I have to say at this point. Please enjoy the refreshments, chat with the others, and feel free to ask questions. All the committee members are wearing large red name badges, so they're easy to find.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear two students and a tutor discussing their plans for next year. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Listen carefully to the first part of the conversation and answer questions 21 to 24.
Hi, Mark. How's it going?
Oh, hi, Lily. I'm okay. Have you decided what course you're going to apply for, then?
Yes, illustration. I've already applied to one college, actually.
I didn't even know there were places that did just illustration.
There aren't many. Most combine it with other areas like painting and graphic art.
Mm.
Unfortunately, there are no courses in London, so I've opted for Birmingham.
Mm. Birmingham? I'm not sure I'd want to study there.
Well, from what I've heard, you're thinking of not studying anywhere, Mark.
Look, I haven't made any decisions yet, but I'm wondering what the point of carrying on at art school really is. I mean, why not just get a studio and paint?
Aren't you enjoying art school now, then?
Yes, I am. But this is a foundation course, isn't it? I wanted to try out all the different areas. You know, sculpture, computer graphics, a bit of everything. Now I know that I really just want to paint, though, I may as well get a studio and do it.
There's nothing more for you to learn, then.
I didn't say that.
This isn't all about a fear of being rejected, is it? I mean, I know you hate applications and interviews and so on. You're not looking for a way out of all that, are you?
No, of course not. I'm no more scared of rejection than anyone else. I mean, people not buying your work, that's real rejection, isn't it?
Now you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen to the next part of the conversation and answer questions 25 to 30.
Hi, do you mind if I join you?
We were talking about next year and applying for courses.
I couldn't help overhearing. What's this all about then, Mark? Is it true that you're thinking of not continuing at college?
I'm looking at other options, yes. I've been reading about artists who claim there's no real advantage in learning formally. There's this Scottish guy who just went to Paris and got a studio. He's doing really well now. In fact, one of the fine art students here dropped out of her course at the end of the first year and just went to Prague. She loves it there.
Hmm. You might just be looking through rose-tinted spectacles there, Mark. There are plenty of people who regret taking that route, you know. For every artist making a living, there are 20 living on the breadline.
OK, I take your point, but I'm thinking about the cost of 3 years at art school as well. Apart from the actual fees, there are all the living expenses. Students are running up at least £30,000 debt by the end of their course.
So this studio you're planning to get, I take it that'll be free then. If you're contemplating working in Paris or Prague, won't that cost practically the same over 3 years?
Maybe, but I'd be selling my paintings, wouldn't I?
In fairness, Mark, very few artists start selling work just like that.
Yes, but will studying for another 3 years mean that I will definitely be able to sell my work?
It won't guarantee it, but it'll make it more likely. In my opinion, anyway.
Mm.
Remember that there are plenty of artists who make their name while they're studying. Art schools put on end-of-year exhibitions, and influential people regularly come in looking for talent. Your work is showcased in a way that just won't happen if you're working in isolation.
Yes, yes, I do see all that. I'm just not convinced. I sometimes question the value of a creative course, full stop. I mean, I often feel almost guilty when I tell people that I'm studying art. I see this look on their face as though they think I should be doing something more useful. I feel that if I get a studio and start working, at least I'd be paying my way.
I think the key factor here is that being at art school exposes you to critical appraisal.
Hmm.
Perhaps the most essential function of further education is the constant feedback and constructive criticism. It's essential to personal development, no matter what the field is.
Yes, we all know artists who paint as a hobby, people who have been doing it for years. They think they're experts and wonder why other people haven't recognised their talents. If only they'd become part of a creative community, they'd understand why that hasn't happened.
Yes, I think Lily's right. It's important to keep developing and responding to feedback. Anyway, don't go making any rash decisions. Come and see me.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear a lecture on volcanic activity and its effect on the atmosphere. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40. Good morning, everyone. In these environmental science lectures, I guess you're all used to hearing about global warming. Well, I'm here today to talk to you about one particular volcano and its effect of global cooling. I'll begin by going back a little bit in time. Towards the middle of 1991, the second largest volcanic eruption of the last century occurred in the Philippines, not far from the capital city, Manila, on the island of Luzon. Mount Pinatubo belongs to a chain of volcanoes in the area, and this was by no means its first eruption. There is evidence of eruptions from approximately 500, 3,000, and 5,500 years ago. The events of the 1991 Mount Pinatubo eruption began in July 1990, when a magnitude 7.8 earthquake occurred 100 kilometres northeast of the Pinatubo region. The sleeping giant was reawakened, but few people had any idea of what was in store for them. In mid-March 1991, many earthquakes were experienced around Mount Pinatubo, and this is when volcano scientists, or volcanologists as they are called, started their investigation of the mountain. Before the disaster, thousands of people lived in very close proximity to the mountain, and on April 2nd, small explosions from vents near the crater dusted their villages with ash. This resulted in the order for evacuations of 5,000 people later that month. Earthquakes and explosions continued to harass the residents, and on June 5th, a level 3 alert was issued for 2 weeks because of the possibility of a major eruption. However, the appearance of a large amount of lava protruding from the mountain on July 7th led to the announcement of a level 5 alert on June 9th, indicating an eruption in progress. An evacuation area within 20 kilometres of the volcano was established, and this time 25,000 people were evacuated. On the following day, Clark Air Base was evacuated, and the danger radius was extended to 30 kilometres from the volcano, resulting in the total evacuation of 58,000 people. On June 15th, just after midday, the eruption of Mount Pinatubo commenced and lasted 9 hours, causing numerous major earthquakes due to the collapse of the land at the top of the mountain and the creation of a huge caldera. What's a caldera, I hear you say. Well, it's obvious, really. With a huge eruption such as this, where enormous amounts of material have exploded into the air, the summit falls into what is now an empty chamber, and thus forms a large crater. As luck would have it, as the eruption was taking place, a tropical storm was passing just to the northeast of Mount Pinatubo, bringing a lot of rainfall to the area. The dust and cinders that had been thrown up into the atmosphere combined with the water vapour from the storm to cause a rainfall of tephra that fell across the whole island of Luzon. Most of the people who perished during the eruption did so because of the weight of the ash collapsing roofs and killing the occupants of the houses. If it hadn't been for that passing storm, the death toll would certainly have been much lower. But that's not all. Besides the ash, Mount Pinatubo expelled between 15 and 30 million tons of sulfur dioxide gas. Can you guess what happened next? Yes, the sulfur dioxide mixed with water and oxygen in the atmosphere to become sulfuric acid, which is a major contributor to ozone reduction. The eruption plume from Mount Pinatubo reached high into the atmosphere, attaining an altitude of 34 kilometers, and the resulting aerosol cloud spread around the Earth in 2 weeks and had covered the planet within a year. During the years 1992 and 1993, the ozone hole situated over Antarctica reached an unprecedented size. The cooling effects of this cloud over the Earth were remarkable. It reduced global temperatures considerably. In the United States, for example, we experienced our third coldest and third wettest summer in 77 years during 1992.
That is the end of part four.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.